95. Farewell, Sharashka. Preoccupied as he was with preparations for his transfer, Niazhdin felt a sudden itch, which became a burning desire, to give Major Shikin a piece of his mind by way of farewell. So when the bell sounded for work, although his 20 had been ordered to wait in their quarters for a guard, he darted through the doors with the other 19. He rushed up to Shikin's office on the third floor, knocked, and was told to enter. Shikin was sitting at his desk, looking gloomy. Something had snapped in him since yesterday. One foot of his had hovered over the abyss, and he knew now what it would be like to have the ground cut out from under him. But he could not vent his hatred of that young pup directly and at once. What Shikin could do, with least danger to himself, was to wear Daron into a frazzle in the hole, then send him back to Vorkuta with a stinking report, ensuring that he was assigned to a punitive work team and would be checking out in a hurry. That would be just as good as putting him on trial and shooting him. He would have called Daronin in for interrogation early that morning, but he was expecting endless protests and delaying tactics from the men who were to be transported. He was not mistaken. In came Niazhdin. Major Shikin had never been able to stand this lean, openly hostile prisoner with his imperturbable self-confidence and precise knowledge of the law. He had for some time past been trying to persuade Yakonov to transfer Niazhdin, and he was maliciously pleased to see the angry look on the man's face. Niazhdin had a talent for putting a complaint into a few trenchant words. He could utter his protest in a single breath while the food hatch in the cell door was momentarily open, or find space for it on a scrap of the absorbent toilet paper made available for submissions from prisoners. In 5 years of incarceration, he had also perfected his own uncompromising way of talking to the authorities. Politely blowing them off, fellow prisoners called it. He never used improper language, but his loftily ironic tone, though there was nothing for his hearer to pick on, was that of a superior to an underling. He began speaking as he entered.
"Citizen Major, I have come to reclaim a book unlawfully taken from me. I feel entitled to assume that communications in the city of Moscow, being what they are, 6 weeks is long enough to ascertain that it is permitted by the censor."
"Book?" Shikin, taken by surprise, could think of nothing sensible to say offhand.
"What book?" "I likewise assume," Niazhdin rapped out, "that you know to which book I refer. The Selected Poems of Sergei Yesenin."
"Yesenin?"
As if only just remembering and shocked by this treasonable name, Major Shikin rocked back in his chair. His grizzled crew cut seemed to express indignation and disgust.
"How can you find it in yourself to ask about Yesenin?"
"Why shouldn't I? He was published here in the Soviet Union."
"That makes no difference.
Moreover, he was published in 1940, that is, he does not fall within the prohibited period, 1917 to 1938.
Shikin frowned. "Prohibited period? Where'd you get that from?"
Niazhdin replied as succinctly as if he had memorized his answers in advance. "A camp censor kindly clarified things for me. During a search before the holiday, my copy of Dahl's dictionary was taken from me on the grounds that it was published in 1935, and therefore subject to the most rigorous scrutiny. When I showed him that the dictionary was a photomechanical copy of the 1881 edition, the censor promptly returned it and explained that there are no objections to pre-revolutionary editions, since the enemies of the people were not then active. And the unfortunate fact is that Yesenin was published in 1940.
After a moment's magisterial silence, Shikin said, "Have it your way." "But have you," he asked weightily, "have you read that book? Have you read all of it? Can you confirm that in writing?"
"You have at present no legal grounds for requiring a signature from me under Article 95 of the Criminal Code of the RSFSR. But orally, I confirm that I have a bad habit of reading those books that are my own property, and, conversely, keeping only those books that I read."
Shikin threw up his hands. "So much the worse for you."
"So then, let me summarize my request. In accordance with point 7 of section B of prison regulations, give me back the book illegally taken from me."
Cowering under this torrent of words, Shikin rose. When he was sitting at his desk, his head did not look like that of a little man. But when he rose, he became smaller, and his arms and legs were seen to be very short. Looking black, he went over to the cupboard, opened it, and took out a miniature Yesenin with a maple-leaf pattern on its jacket. There were markers in several places. Shikin made himself comfortable in his armchair, still without inviting Nyazhin to sit down, and began a leisurely inspection of the marked passages. Nyazhin calmly seated himself, leaned forward with his hands on his knees, and fixed Shikin with a hostile stare.
"Take this, for instance," the major said with a sigh,
and read the lines with as much feeling as if he were kneading dough.
"Lifeless hands, alien hands, these songs cannot live where you are. But the ears of corn that are horses will grieve for their old master forever. Who, I ask you, is this master? Whose hands does he mean?"
The prisoner looked at the security officer's own puffy white hands. Yesenin had the limited vision of his class, and there were many things he did not fully understand, just like Pushkin and Gogol. Something in Nyazhin's voice made Shikin glance at him apprehensively. What was to stop him from suddenly hurling himself at the major, now that he had nothing more to lose? Just in case, Shikin rose and opened the door an inch or two.
"And what does this bit mean?" he said, returning to his chair. "A rose all white and a crab all black. I tried to join in wedlock. Etc. What is he getting at?"
The prisoner's taut throat quivered.
"It's very simple," he answered. "You shouldn't try to reconcile the white rose of truth with the black crab of wickedness."
The short-armed, big-headed, dark-faced godfather sat before him like a black crab.
"However, Citizen Major,"
Nyazhin spoke rapidly, his words tumbling over one another,
"I do not have time to enter into textual analysis with you. My escort party awaits me. You announced 6 weeks ago that you would refer the matter to the All-Union Censor's office. Did you do so?"
Shikin shrugged and noisily closed the little yellow book.
"I am not accountable to you for my actions. I shall not return the book to you, and if I did, you would not be allowed to take it away with you."
Nyazhin stood up angrily, with his eyes fixed on Yesenin. He remembered that his wife's loving hands had once held the little book and written in it, "So may all that you have lost be returned to you." Words like a hail of bullets sped effortlessly from his lips.
"Citizen Major, you have, I hope, not forgotten that over 2 years I've repeatedly requested the Ministry of State Security to return some Polish zlotys improperly confiscated from me, and although it was converted to rubles at a 20th of its value, I did get my money back through the Supreme Soviet. And I hope you have not forgotten how I insisted on being given 5 grams of grade 1 flour. I was laughed at, but I got them. And I could mention many other instances. I warn you that I will not let you keep that book. If I'm sent to Kolyma, I'll wrest it from you before I die there. I'll stuff the letterboxes of the Central Committee and the Council of Ministers with complaints about you. So hand it over now and save yourself trouble."
The major in the State Security Service could not hold out against this doomed prisoner, stripped of his rights and on his way to a lingering death in a labor camp. He had, in fact, made inquiries of the central censorship and, to his surprise, been told that the book in question was not formally prohibited.
Formally.
Shikin's unerring sense of smell told him that this was a blunder on somebody's part and that the book certainly should be forbidden. But he needed to defend his name from the imputations of this indefatigable troublemaker.
"Very well, then, you can have it back. But we won't let you take it away with you."
Nyazhin walked triumphantly to the stairs, pressing his beloved shiny yellow volume to his breast. It was a token success at a moment when everything was collapsing around him. On the landing, he passed a group of prisoners discussing the latest developments. Saramaka was holding forth, but taking care that his voice would not carry to their masters.
"What do you think they're doing? Sending guys like that off to the camps? What for?
And what about Ruska Doronin?
What bastards informed on him, eh?"
Nyazhin made for the acoustics laboratory, in a hurry to destroy his notes before a guard took charge of him. Prisoners due to be transferred were not supposed to walk around the special prison freely. Nerzhin could enjoy this last brief interval of freedom only because so many were to be transported, and because the junior lieutenant was as negligent and easygoing as ever. He flung open the laboratory door and saw that the steel cabinet was wide open, and Simochka, now wearing her ugly striped dress again, and a grey goat-hair scarf around her shoulders, was standing between its doors. She sensed Nerzhin's presence without looking, and froze, as if she could not make up her mind what to take out of the cabinet. Without stopping to think, he took refuge between the steel doors and whispered,
"Serafima Vitalievna, after what happened last night, it's heartless of me to turn to you. But things I've been working on for many years are in danger. What shall I do? Burn them? Or can you keep them for me?"
She already knew that he was leaving. He raised sad eyes, red from lack of sleep, and said,
"Give them to me."
Somebody came in, and Nerzhin hurried over to his desk, where he found Reutemann. Reutemann looked dismayed.
"Gleb Vikentich, this is most annoying," he said. "Nobody warned me. I had no idea. Until today. Too late to change anything."
Nerzhin gave the man, whom until now he had thought sincere, an icily pitying look.
"Adam Veniaminovich, this isn't my first day here. Such things aren't done without consulting the heads of laboratories."
He started emptying the drawers of his desk. Reutemann looked pained.
"Believe me, Gleb Vikentich, I didn't know. Nobody asked me. I wasn't warned."
He said it loudly enough for the whole laboratory to hear. Beads of sweat stood out on his brow. He watched uncomprehendingly while Nerzhin collected his belongings. It was true. He had not been consulted.
"Shall I give my notes on articulation to Serafima Vitalievna?"
Nerzhin asked casually. Reutemann walked slowly toward the door without replying.
"Here you are then, Serafima Vitalievna,"
Nerzhin said, bringing her the first load of files and folders and loose sheets of graph paper. He was about to slip his most treasured possession, the three notebooks, into one of the files, but an inner voice warned him against it. Her outstretched hands were warm enough, but how long would she stay a virgin and faithful to him? He transferred the notebooks to one of his pockets and gave the files to Simochka. The library at Alexandria had burned down. Manuscripts in monasteries had been burned to keep them out of the wrong hands. And soot from the Lubyanka's chimneys, soot from countless bundles of burned paper, had fluttered down onto the heads of prisoners led out for exercise in the pen on the prison roof. More great thoughts had gone up in smoke, perhaps, than had ever been made public. He felt sure that if he survived, he could reproduce his work. Nerzhin rattled a box of matches, ran out of the lab, and returned 10 minutes later, pale and expressionless. Prantchikov walked in.
"It's incredible," he said. "We've lost all sense and feeling. We don't even kick up a fuss. We're transported, shipped, forwarded. You can transport luggage, but what gives them the right to transport people?"
Valentulia's outburst found an echo in the prisoners' hearts. Disturbed by news of the transfer, not one of those in the laboratory was working. A transportation was always a terrifying reminder that we may be next. A transportation made every prisoner, even if unaffected by it, reflect that his fate was in the balance, and that the axe of the gulag was poised to cut short his existence. Even Zeks with no black marks against them were invariably sent away from the special prison 2 years or so before the end of their sentence, so that they would forget all they had done there and lose their skills before they were freed. Men serving 25 years would never see the end of their sentence, so the security services happily recruited them for the special prisons. Prisoners surrounded Nerzhin, some of them sitting on desks instead of chairs, as if to emphasize the unusual importance of the occasion. Their mood was one of melancholy resignation. Like mourners at a funeral recalling all the good things the deceased had done, they praised Nerzhin as a zealous defender of prisoners' rights. They remembered, among other things, the famous story of the fine flower. He had showered the prison authorities and the Ministry of Internal Affairs with complaints about the failure to issue him personally 5 grams of the best flour per day. Prison rules forbade collective complaints, or complaints from one person on behalf of others. The prisoner was supposedly being re-educated in the spirit of socialism, but he was forbidden to suffer for the common good. At that time, convicts in the special prison were still underfed, and the fight for those 5 grams generated more excitement than any event on the international scene. The gripping epic had ended in victory for Nyazhin. The commandant's deputy in charge of stockrooms was relieved of his duties, and the flour allowance supplied the whole prisoner population with extra noodles twice a week. They remembered, too, Nyazhin's campaign for a longer exercise period on Sundays, which had, however, ended in defeat. Nyazhin himself, however, hardly listened to these graveside eulogies. He was thinking that the moment for action had arrived. The worst had happened, and only he could do anything to improve matters. He had handed over his notes on speech tests to Serafima, and all secret material to Reutmann's assistant, burned or torn up all his personal papers, stacked all his library books in piles, and was now rummaging in his drawers and distributing what was left to his friends. It had already been decided who was to have his revolving yellow chair, his German roll-top desk, his inkwell, his roll of coloured and marbled sheets of paper made by the Lawrence Company. The deceased distributed his legacies in person, and beneficiaries gave him 2 or sometimes 3 packs of cigarettes in return. This was standard practice in the Sharashka. In this world, their world, cigarettes were plentiful. In the next world, the Gulag, they were more precious than bread. Rubin came in from his top-secret group. He looked sad, and there were bags under his eyes. Surveying his books, Nyazhin said, "I'd make you a present of Yesenin if you liked him."
"However did you manage to get him back?"
"Only he's too remote from the proletariat."
"You haven't got a shaving brush,"
Rubin said, producing from his pocket a brush with a shiny plastic handle, which any prisoner would find luxurious.
"And I vowed never to shave till I get my pardon, so take this one."
Rubin never said, "till I'm released," which might simply mean till he'd served his sentence, but always, "till I get my pardon," never doubting that some day he would. "Thanks, old man, but you've become such a special prison prisoner that you've forgotten how things are in the camps. What makes you think they'll let me shave myself where I'm going? Will you help me take the books back?" They collected the books and magazines into neat piles. The other prisoners drifted away.
"Well, how's your protégé?"
Gleb asked quietly.
"I've heard the 2 main ones were arrested last night."
"Why 2?
"They're both suspects. History demands victims."
"How do you know you've got the right one?"
"I think we've caught him. They've promised to send us the interrogator's tapes by dinner time. We'll compare them."
Nyazhin finished stacking books and straightened up.
"What does the Soviet Union want with the atomic bomb anyway? That fellow had his head screwed on right."
"A Moscow airhead, a no-good troublemaker, take my word for it."
Heavily laden with library books, they left the laboratory and walked up the main staircase. In the window space along the upper corridor, they stopped for a rest and to get a better grip on their collapsing bundles of books. Yezhin's eyes, lit with feverish excitement while he was making his final arrangements, were now fixed in a lackluster stare.
"You know what?" he said. "You and I have been together less than 3 years, spent most of that time arguing and trashing each other's beliefs, and now that I'm losing you forever, I realize clearly that you are one of those I most—"
His voice broke. Rubin's large brown eyes, which many people had only seen flashing with anger, shone now with shy kindliness.
"I know what you mean. Give me a kiss, you brute."
And he smothered Nyazhin in his piratical black beard. After that, they went straight to the library, where Sologdin caught up with them. He looked very worried. He carelessly slammed the door so that the glass panes rattled, and the librarian looked round in annoyance.
"Well, Gleb, my boy, that's it then," Sologdin said. "It has come to pass. You are leaving us."
Ignoring the Old Testament fanatic, Sologdin looked only at Nyazhin. Rubin, equally disinclined to make peace with the boring Hidalgo, looked the other way.
"Yes, you're leaving us. A pity. A great pity."
They had found so much to say to each other across the sawhorse, argued so passionately in the exercise yard. Now it was too late, and not the place for Sir Logdin to teach Gleb, as he had always meant to, the rules that governed his own thinking and his life. The librarian vanished among the stacks, and Sir Logdin said quietly,
"But you really must stop being such a sceptic. It's just a facile excuse for refusing to fight."
Nerzin replied just as quietly,
"But what you were saying yesterday about this hopeless, cockeyed country, that's even more facile. I don't know what to think."
Sir Logdin's blue eyes flashed, and his white teeth gleamed in a brilliant smile.
"You and I should have talked more. You still have so much to learn. Remember, time is money. It still isn't too late. Tell them you're willing to stay here as a designer, and maybe I can get you kept on. In a group we've set up here."
Reuben darted a look of surprise at him.
"But I give you fair warning. You'll have to put your back into it."
Nerzin sighed.
"Thanks, Dmitri, old man. I could have done something like that, but while I'm putting my back into it, would I ever have time for self-improvement? I've more or less made up my mind to try an experiment. There's a proverb that says, it's not the sea that drowns you, it's the puddle. I want to try a dive into the sea."
"You do?
Well, just be careful.
It's a great pity, Gleb, my boy. A great pity."
Sir Logdin, looking preoccupied, was in a hurry, but forced himself not to hurry away. The three of them stood waiting while the librarian, herself a lieutenant in the security service, with dyed hair and heavily made up, lazily checked Nerzin's library card. Gleb, upset by the ill feeling between his friends, said, lowering his voice in the hushed library,
"Listen, you two, you must make up."
Neither Sir Logdin nor Reuben looked around.
"Mitya,"
Gleb insisted. Sir Logdin raised his piercing, cold blue eyes.
"Why are you addressing me?"
He sounded surprised. Gleb tried again.
"Lyova."
Reuben looked at him wearily.
"Do you know why horses live so long?"
He paused briefly and went on.
"Because they never try to explain their feelings."
Once he had finished handing in the prison's property and his work notes, Nerzin was ordered by a guard to go on to the prison and get ready to leave. As he went along the hallway, clutching several packs of cigarettes, he met Potapov, hurrying somewhere with a box under his arm. Potapov at work walked quite differently from Potapov in the exercise yard. In spite of his limp, he moved quickly, head jerking backward and forward on his stiff neck, eyes screwed up, gazing into the distance, as if his head and eyes were trying to outpace his no longer young legs. Potapov was anxious to say goodbye to Nerzin and the others who were leaving, but the moment he entered the laboratory that morning, he was gripped by the inner logic of his work and had no thought or feeling for anything else. This capacity for total absorption in his work, forgetting all else that was happening in his life, was the basis of his success outside as an engineer, one of the 5-year plan's indispensable robots, and it had helped him to withstand the hardships of prison life. Nerzin barred his way.
"That's it, then, Andreich," he said.
"The deceased was in good spirits and wore a smile."
Potapov made an effort, and his eyes lit up with ordinary human comprehension. The hand not holding the box reached for his neck as if to scratch it.
"I'd give you my Yesenin, only apart from Pushkin you don't—"
"We will all end up there,"
Potapov said sadly. Nerzin sighed.
"Where will we meet next? In the Cotless Transit Prison? On the Indigir goldfields? Somehow I don't believe that we will ever meet walking freely down a city street. Do you?"
Half closing his eyes, Potapov declaimed,
"I have closed my eyes to phantom joys, but distant hopes trouble my heart at times."
Markushov, beside himself with excitement, stuck his head out through the door of number 7.
"You, Potapov!"
he shouted impatiently.
"Where are the filters? You're holding up the work."
The co-authors of The Buddha's Smile embraced awkwardly. Packs of White Sea Canal cigarettes fell to the floor.
"You know how it is,"
Potapov said.
We're busy spawning. No time for anything else.
Spawning was Potapov's word for the rush and muddle prevalent in the Marfino Institute and in all the activities of the Soviet state, as newspapers reluctantly admitted when they spoke of shock work and last-minuteism.
Write to me,
Potapov said in conclusion, and they both burst out laughing. Those words, so natural when people say goodbye, sound in prison like a cruel joke. There was no postal service between the islands of the Gulag. Holding his box of filters under one arm, Potapov dashed off along the hallway again, with his head bobbing backward and forward. His limp was barely discernible. Nyezhin, too, hurried off, to the semicircular cell where he began assembling his belongings, acutely aware of the cruel surprises that might await him when he was subjected to body searches at Marfino and later on in Butyrki. The guard looked in twice to hurry him up. The others had already left of their own accord or been chased out to prison HQ. Just as Nyezhin was finishing his preparations, Spiridon came into the room, wearing his black belted tunic and bringing a breath of outdoor freshness. Removing the ginger cap with the big ear flaps, he carefully turned back the bedding, tucked into a white comforter, on a bunk close to Nyezhin's, and lowered his dirty padded trousers onto the steel frame.
Spiridon Danilich, Nyezhin said, holding out the book to him. I've got my Yesenin.
The snake gave it back, did he?
Spiridon's gloomy features, which seemed more deeply wrinkled than ever, brightened momentarily.
What matters to me is not so much the book, Danilich, Nyezhin explained. What's important is that they mustn't treat us like dirt.
Spiridon nodded.
Here, take it. Something to remember me by.
Don't you want to take it with you?
Spiridon asked, embarrassed.
Wait a minute.
Nyezhin took the book back and started looking for a page.
I'll find it in a minute. You can read it for yourself.
Better be on your way, Glib,
Spiridon said gloomily.
You know what it's like in labor camps. Your heart wants to be working and making, but your feet drag you to the sick bay.
I'm not new at the game, Danilich. I'm not afraid. I want to try a bit of real work. You know what they say. The sea won't drown you. The puddle will.
Only then did Nyezhin look closely at Spiridon and realize that he was very upset, more than he would be if he were simply parting from a friend. The events of the day before, the harsh new regulations, the unmasking of the informers, Ruska's arrest, the scene with Simuchka, his discussion with Gerasimovich, had made him forget completely that Spiridon should have received a letter from home.
What about your letter? Did you get your letter, Danilich?
Spiridon was clutching the letter in his pocket. He took it out. The envelope was frayed in the middle where it had been folded.
Here. But you haven't got time.
Spiridon's lips trembled. That envelope had been folded and unfolded over and over again since yesterday. The address was written in the large, bold hand of Spiridon's daughter, Vera, acquired in the 5 years of schooling that were all she had received. As he and Spiridon usually did, Nyezhin began reading the letter aloud.
My dear Daddy, I don't know how I can carry on living, let alone write to you. What bad people there are in the world. They tell you things, and then they let you down.
Nyezhin's voice failed him. He glanced at Spiridon and met his wide open, steady, almost blind eyes under their bushy red eyebrows. But he was not allowed a second to think and try to find a word of consolation that would not ring false. The door was flung open, and Nadilashin rushed in, looking furious.
Nyezhin, he yelled, if people treat you decently, this is what they can expect. All the others are ready and waiting. You're the last.
The guards were in a hurry to get the transferees into headquarters before the lunch break, so that they would meet none of the other prisoners. Nyezhin embraced Spiridon with one arm around his unshaved neck.
Get on with it,
the junior lieutenant yelled.
I'm not waiting a minute longer.
Dear old Spiridon,
Nyezhin said, embracing the red-haired yardman. Spiridon sighed hoarsely and waved his hand.
Goodbye, glib boy.
Goodbye forever, Spiridon Danilich."
They kissed. Nerzin picked up his things and rushed out, followed by the duty officer. With hands from which washing would never remove years of ingrained dirt, Spiridon picked up from the bed the open book with the maple leaves on its jacket, put his daughter's letter in it as a marker, and went off to his room. He did not notice that he had knocked his shaggy cap off the bed with his knee, and it stayed there on the floor.